So we return to the ascent of the sacrifice, the second part, the works of love, the works of life. He was in the middle of a wonderful description, a symbolic representation of what is this ascent of the self-offering to the Supreme and what it brings to the person who gives utterly and a complete adoration. And of course, it is a complete surrender that's necessary, as he expressed earlier in his book, The Mother, and as he would asseverate again and again in his letters, that if you want to have this unification, this yoga, state of oneness, yoking your being to that, then in a sense you have to give up your littleness, all that you possess, all that you experience. It doesn't really belong to you. It goes into this universal conflagration. Because the fire exists not only in your heart, but it is a world fire as well. And all is constantly in an act of continuing consecration to the Supreme, from which all extends. So to come to some knowledge of that means that you become a co-creator, you become a direct participant, you are aware of this movement. That's wonderful. It's liberating. It's a rapturous experience. So the last sentence of that previous paragraph, all life turned into this cult, all actions done in the love of the divine and in the love of the world and its creatures, seen and felt as the divine manifested in many disguises, become by that very fact part of an integral yoga. It is the inner offering of the heart's adoration, the soul of it in the symbol, the spirit of it in the act that is the very life of the sacrifice. So these words, symbol and act, mean much to Sri Aurobindo, because all the universe and every small particular thing in it is a symbol of the larger reality, in some way captures a unique aspect of that which is beyond form and name, but assumes that guise, the spirit of it in the act, so it is dynamic. This inner offering of the dynamic form, that's the force of the sacrifice. If this offering is to be complete and universal, then a turning of all our emotions to the divine is imperative. This is the intensest way of purification for the human heart, more powerful than any ethical or aesthetic catharsis could ever be by its half power and superficial pressure. A psychic fire within must be lit, into which all is thrown with the divine name upon it. So he is taking categorical, the counting, the identification of every movement, becoming conscious of it, and deliberately converting all these emotions with their difference into a common offering. In that fire, All the emotions are compelled to cast off their grosser elements, and those that are undivine perversions are burned away, and the others discard their insufficiencies, till a spirit of largest love and a stainless divine delight arises out of the flame and smoke and frankincense. It is the divine love which so emerges, that extended an inward feeling to the divine in man and to all creatures in an active universal equality, will be more potent for the perfectibility of life and a more real instrument than the ineffective mental ideal of brotherhood can ever be. So this offering of the emotions into the sacred fire converts them into love, which establishes the oneness in nature. And yes, he does adhere to the idea of the perfectibility of life. It's not simply a holdover from 19th century idealism. Certainly that was an element of socio-political thinking in those days. Sri Aurobindo insists that it's possible because of the transformative power that a spiritual consciousness would have entering into living beings upon earth and manifesting the richness of that superior life plane here in these terms. That is the only way that life is perfectible. If we try to perfect life from within the ignorance, within the belt of matter, life, and mind, you can assure yourself that it will be defeated. It cannot be. It is only by bringing the higher nature into it that it can be effected. It is this poured out into acts that could alone create a harmony in the world and a true unity between all its creatures. All else strives in vain towards that end, so long as divine love has not disclosed itself as the heart of the delivered manifestation in terrestrial nature. It is through love that we best effectuate the unity that we seek. Love lightens darkness, takes that which is disintegrated, and brings it back into its embrace. It is here that the emergence of the secret psychic being in us as the leader of the sacrifice is of the most importance. For this inmost being alone can bring with it the full power of the spirit in the act, the soul in the symbol. Remember in the previous paragraph he was talking about the act and the symbol? Here he comes back to it again. What gives it force is the discovery of the secret fire within. That is the power of Agni. The full power, and that full power does not exist simply from within either. It is a superconscient reality. It is what is para. It is the supreme beyond. So he's referring again to para prakriti. This emergence, he continues here, it alone can assure, even while the spiritual consciousness is incomplete, the perennial freshness and sincerity and beauty of the symbol, and prevent it from becoming a dead form or a corrupted and corrupting magic. It alone can preserve for the act its power with its significance. And again, those of you who have read Abhinavagupta and seen that his whole philosophy is pinned upon the beauty of the divine reality and its manifestation as a world is very akin to what Sri Aurobindo is saying here. Sri Aurobindo has the mellifluity of English at his side. Abhinavagupta had wondrous Sanskrit. All the other members of our being, mind, life force, physical or body consciousness, are too much under the control of the ignorance to be a sure instrumentation, and much less can they be a guide or the source of an unerring impulse. So again, if what leads this sacrifice is something of this manifestation of Prakriti, whether the mind leads or the life powers and the high emotions or the impulse of the physical towards immortality, it is necessarily formed from ignorance and cannot achieve. Matter, life, and mind are a construct of Prakriti, lower nature, not the superior nature, Paraprakriti. Always, the greater part of the motive and action of these powers clings to the old law, the deceiving tablets, the cherished inferior movements of nature, and they meet with reluctance, alarm, or revolt, or obstructing inertia, the voices and the forces that call and impel us to exceed and transform ourselves into a greater being and a wider nature. In their major part, the response is either a resistance or a qualified or temporizing acquiescence. For even if they follow the call, they yet tend, when not consciously, then by automatic habit, to bring into the spiritual action their own natural disabilities and errors. At every moment, they are moved to take egoistic advantage of the psychic and spiritual influences and can be detected using the power, joy, or light these bring into us for a lower life motive. Afterwards, too, even when the seeker has opened to the divine love, transcendental, universal, or immanent, yet if he tries to pour it into life, he meets the power of obscuration and perversion of these lower nature forces. Always they draw away towards pitfalls, pour into that higher intensity their diminishing elements, seek to capture the descending power for themselves and their interests, and degrade it into an aggrandized mental, vital, or physical instrumentation for desire and ego. Sri Aurobindo was very familiar with this because he battled it in his own sadhana. Continually he would make an advance, and then in bringing the higher power down, find that it would settle into old, familiar levels, as if water sought to go where it was accustomed to being. And he couldn't make it stick, and so he found that only if he continued to rise to a higher and higher level could he make an imprint that could last upon the physical, emotional, and mental being. So this arousal of the psychic being and bringing it to the front of the nature meant that he had command of the interior regions, and lifting all of these up in a sacramental giving to a higher consciousness with which he was in touch meant that through this corridor of exploration, the psychic fire could commune with the universal fire of the spiritual consciousness above and be useful in imprinting itself upon matter. So inside, and then bringing all that's in the material, emotional, and mental world into that fiery offering in self-giving. And then the smoke of the offering goes up and establishes a point of connection between the higher dimension, the higher consciousness, and that divine element which represents the world's progress here. That's the psychic. Instead of a divine love, creator of a new heaven and a new earth of truth and light, they would hold it here prisoner as a tremendous sanction and glorifying force of sublimation to gild the mud of the old earth and color with it rose and sapphire the old turbid unreal skies of sentimentalizing vital imagination and mental idealized chimera. If that falsification is permitted, the higher light and power and bliss withdraw. There is a fall back to a lower status. Brashta, the term for what has fallen from yoga. Or else, the realization remains tied to an insecure halfway and mixture, or is covered and even submerged by an inferior exaltation that is not the true Ananda. And again, it's not only Sri Aurobindo's experience, but it can be your own experience if, as you strive forward and make ascertainable gains in inner progress, that when you come and bring it back and apply it to the world as it is, to our nature as it is, if we make a ready compromise with those elements in us, they will tend to dilute, diffuse, deflect the power and accustomize it to their own life, gild what they already possess, but not offer their kingdom to the Supreme. It is for this reason that divine love, which is at the heart of all creation and the most powerful of all redeeming and creative forces, has yet been the least frontally present in earthly life, the least successfully redemptive, the least creative. And this is reminiscent of Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother, in the sixth chapter, where he describes what that power yet not descended could bring to the earth with its promise. Human nature has been unable to bear it in its purity for the very reason that it is the most powerful, pure, rare, and intense of all the divine energies. What little could be seized has been corrupted at once into a vital pietistic ardor, a defenseless religious or ethical sentimentalism, a sensuous or even sensual erotic mysticism of the roseate colored mind, or passionately turbid life impulse, and with these simulations compensated its inability to house the mystic flame that could rebuild the world with its tongues of sacrifice. This is a very direct reference to Agni and the seven tongues of sacrifice described in the Rig Veda. It is only the inmost psychic being, unveiled and emerging in its full power, that can lead the pilgrim sacrifice unscathed through these ambushes and pitfalls. At each moment, it catches, exposes, repels the mind's and the life's falsehoods, seizes hold on the truth of the divine love and Ananda, and separates it from the excitement of the mind's ardors and the blind enthusiasms of the misleading life force. So Agni knows how to do it. It is the knower of all things born. Its other name is Jatavedas. Who knows all things born? But all things that are true at their core in mind and life and the physical being, it extricates and takes with it in the journey till they stand on the heights, new in spirit and sublime in figure. This is the very image of the Vedic sacrifice. Agni receives the ghee, for instance, the clarified butter, which represents your best thoughts, your insights, your deepest considerations, your recognition of reality. Poured onto that flame, it's carried upward. It burns and then lifts the ghee offered, the clarification of your life offered, until it lands in the lap of the divine in many forms. And so this is the ascent of the sacrifice that he's describing. All things that are true that you find in your life, the sap, the essence of it, you draw out, you pour it into that fire, and your soul, in its ascent, carries it into communion with those divine powers. And then what's the next stage after that? And yet, even the leading of the inmost psychic being is not found sufficient until it has succeeded in raising itself out of this mass of inferior nature to the highest spiritual levels, and the divine spark and flame descended here have rejoined themselves to their original fiery ether. So he's describing the journey of the psychic, the individual aspect of the divine, into communion with the universal divine. You remember that image from the Mundaka Upanishad with the millions of sparks that are thrown out from that central fire. This is a direct reference to that. We have come here from that fire, but we have to go back there. And it's the journey back that is the ascent, that is the offering. For there is there no longer a spiritual consciousness, still imperfect and half lost to itself in the thick sheaths of human mind, life, and body, but the full spiritual consciousness and its purity, freedom, and intense wideness. He's talking about the higher realms. There, as it is the eternal knower that becomes the knower in us and mover and user of all knowledge, so it is the eternal all-blissful who is the adored, attracting to himself the eternal divine portion of his being and joy that has gone out into the play of the universe, the infinite lover pouring himself out in the multiplicity of his own manifested selves in a happy oneness. So not only is this fire an agent of consciousness, takes you to the true consciousness, but it takes you from the divided pleasures and pains of the ordinary world as we meet it, matter, life, and mind, above into that which is born of ananda, born of delight, born of bliss. So the way to recover bliss is again through the psyche. All beauty in the world is there, the beauty of the beloved, and all forms of beauty have to stand under the light of that eternal beauty and submit themselves to the sublimating and transfiguring power of the unveiled divine perfection. All bliss and joy are there of the all-blissful, and all inferior forms of enjoyment, happiness, or pleasure are subjected to the shock of the intensity of its floods or currents, and either they are broken to pieces as inadequate things under its convicting stress, or compelled to transmute themselves into the forms of the divine ananda. This again is redolent of Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother. Thus, for the individual consciousness, a force is manifested which can deal sovereignly in it, with the diminutions and degradations of the values of the ignorance. At last, it begins to be possible to bring down into life the immense reality and intense concreteness of the love and joy that are of the eternal. So here he describes the descent of the Godhead. So if this first phase that he's described is the ascent of the psychic being and its essential experience of the world in an offering to the Supreme, then the second phase is the descent, the empowering descent of the spiritual consciousness from above. So the psychic goes upwards and its individuality is yoked to the universality of the Spirit. Then the power of the Spirit descends into this universalized individual and concretely establishes itself there. He continues, or at any rate, it will be possible for our spiritual consciousness to raise itself out of mind into the supramental light and force and vastness. There, in the light and potency of the supramental gnosis, are the splendor and joy of a power of divine self-expression and self-organization which could rescue and recreate even the world of the ignorance into a figure of the truth of the Spirit. So he's been referring to these terms as we move along, light and existence and ananda and the power of consciousness. So he's suggesting that as we get to the heights of the spiritual consciousness and discover its secret levers of power, that we can rise into the supramental, which is itself a manifestation. Even though we think of it as being knowledge will, it is also knowledge will and delight, manifesting the consciousness force and the ananda of Satchit Ananda, true being, true consciousness force, true bliss. That is what descending can transform the world, ultimately. The supramental is key to that. There, in the supreme, pardon me, there in the supramental gnosis is the fulfillment, the culminating height, the all-embracing extent of the inner adoration, the profound and integral union, the flaming wings of love, upbearing the power and joy of a supreme knowledge. For supramental love brings an active ecstasy that surpasses the void, passive peace and stillness which is the heaven of the liberated mind and does not betray the deeper, greater calm, which is the beginning of the supramental silence. Sri Aurobindo, in a way, has thrown shade on some of the great spiritual realizations of the past because they have not brought dynamic power. In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power, he wrote in Savitri. The silence of the supermind contains within it ananda, but an ananda that can step forward and become active. If you achieve liberation at the level of the mind, you can be free from the vagaries of the world. This is the achievement of the Buddha. This is the achievement of Shankara. What have they achieved? A withdrawal from all global activities, no transformation of life, the rare individual here and there hies away into sublimities above, but there, ensconced in peace, are unaffected by the passage of time here. Sri Aurobindo insists on bringing that spiritual consciousness down dynamically into the world to face the divisions among the dualities and restore unity here. That unification is emblematic of divine love, is emblematic of a knowledge which knows by identity, of a power that enforces through communion. The unity of a love which is able to include in itself all differences without being diminished or abrogated by their present limitations and apparent dissonances is raised to its full potentiality on the supramental level. For there, an intense oneness with all creatures, founded on a profound oneness of the soul with the divine, can harmonize with a play of relations that only makes the oneness more perfect and absolute. The power of love, supramentalized, can take hold of all living relations without hesitation or danger and turn them Godwards, delivered from their crude, mixed, and petty human settings and sublimated into the happy material of a divine life. For it is the very nature of the supramental experience that it can perpetuate the play of difference without forfeiting or in the least diminishing either the divine union or the infinite oneness. For a supramentalized consciousness, it would be utterly possible to embrace all contacts with men and the world in a purified flame force and with a transfigured significance, because the soul would then perceive always as the object of all emotion and all seeking for love or beauty, the one eternal, and could spiritually use a wide and liberated life urge to meet and join with that one divine in all things and all creatures. So, he's just described how we save the globe, how we save the earth, by finding our soul, living in constant communion with a wider world based in a spiritual consciousness, and drawing down the transfiguring power of the divine reality through the energies, the light, the love of the supramental. It's a joyful journey because we begin by finding joy within, the seed of Ananda inside. And then every step is delightful. All the work worth it, all the challenge embraceable. So we'll go forward with the chapter more next week. That's where we'll put our bookmark this time. So if you're with me still, we'll go to Savitri, Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the World, since we're on a journey, and this is the ascent of the sacrifice. This is Canto 15, The Kingdoms of the Greater Knowledge. And we'll start somewhere in page 298. A thousand roads leaped into eternity, or singing ran to meet God's veilless face. The known released him from its limiting chain. He knocked at the doors of the unknowable. Thence, gazing with an immeasurable outlook, one with self's inlook into its own pure vasts, he saw the splendor of the spirit's realms, the greatness and wonder of its boundless works, the power and passion leaping from its calm, the rapture of its movement and its rest, and its fire-sweet miracle of transcendent life, the million-pointing, undivided grasp of its vision of one same stupendous all, its inexhaustible acts in a timeless time, a space that is its own infinity. A glorious multiple of one radiant self, answering to joy with joy, to love with love, all there were moving mansions of God bliss. Eternal and unique, they lived the one. Their forces are great outbursts of God's truth, and objects are its pure spiritual shapes. Spirit no more is hid from its own view. All sentience is a sea of happiness, and all creation is an act of light. Out of the neutral silence of his soul, he passed to its fields of puissance and of calm, and saw the powers that stand above the world, traversed the realms of the supreme idea, and sought the summit of created things and the almighty source of cosmic change. There, knowledge called him to her mystic peaks, where thought is held in a vast internal sense, and feeling swims across a sea of peace, and vision climbs beyond the reach of time. An equal of the first creator sears, accompanied by an all-revealing light, he moved through regions of transcendent truth, inward, immense, innumerably one. Their distance was his own huge spirit's extent. Delivered from the fictions of the mind, time's triple dividing step baffled no more. Its inevitable and continuous stream, the long flow of its manifesting course, was held in spirit's single wide regard. A universal beauty showed its face. The invisible, deep-fraught significances, here sheltered behind form's insensible screen, uncovered to him their deathless harmony and the key to the wonder book of common things. In their uniting law stood up revealed the multiple measures of the upbuilding force, the lines of the world geometer's technique, the enchantments that uphold the cosmic web, and the magic underlying simple shapes. On peaks where silence listens with still heart to the rhythmic meters of the rolling worlds, he served the sessions of the triple fire. On the rim of two continents of slumber and trance, he heard the ever unspoken reality's voice, awaken revelation's mystic cry, the birthplace found of the sudden infallible word, and lived in the rays of an intuitive sun. Absolved from the ligaments of death and sleep, he rode the lightning seas of cosmic mind and crossed the ocean of original sound. On the last step to the supernal birth, he trod along extinction's narrow edge near the high verges of eternity, and mounted the gold ridge of the world dream between the slayer and the savior fires. The belt he reached of the unchanging truth met borders of the inexpressible light and thrilled with the presence of the ineffable. Above him, he saw the flaming hierarchies. the wings that fold around created space, the sun-eyed guardians and the golden sphinx and the tiered plains and the immutable lords. A wisdom waiting on omniscience sat voiceless in a vast passivity. It judged not, measured not, nor strove to know, but listened for the veiled all-seeing thought and the burden of a calm, transcendent voice. So, namaste, Jai Ma.